Okay, so we have in studio with us Pat Milam, who's going to tell us a little bit about his experience with trying to get treatment for his son. But right before we do that, I just wanted to read a statement from Representative Tim Murphy, who's introduced a bill, H.R. 2646, the Helping Families and Mental Health Crisis Act, which was actually co-authored with Eddie Bernice Johnson to address alternatives to incarceration, homelessness, and death for people with serious mental illness, and AOT funding, assisted outpatient treatment, which is what we're going to be talking about today, is part of that bill. And there was a statement by Tim Murphy about racial disparities and how mental illness affects people of race. And given the nature of this radio station, I wanted to read that statement. A person with serious mental illness is twice as likely to have obesity, diabetes, stroke, or heart disease, among many other illnesses. They are three times more likely to have a metabolic syndrome. They are four times more likely to have high blood pressure. And when they take medication such as second-generation antipsychotics, there is a huge increased risk for diabetes and cardiovascular disease. The reason I point these out is that when you look at folks with serious mental illness and you think that by ignoring them, they're going to go away, they will show up in the ER. They will show up in inpatient and outpatient care. And even if not for the psychiatric problems, they'll show up somewhere, and particularly if they're Medicaid and Medicare. Or without those, someone's going to be paying for their care that we could have prevented the need for them. Among minorities, federal government programs, I believe, are neglectful and abusive toward people with serious mental illness. In particular, I believe those federal policies are harshest on people who are minorities and low income. Let me describe them. If you're an African American, you're half as likely to receive psychiatric treatment as non-black. Much of that is because there just aren't enough services in many of the communities. Only 3% of psychiatrists and 2% of psychologists are African American. 5% of psychiatrists and 3% of psychologists are Latino. But among the Spanish with the mental health disorder, fewer than 1 in 11 see a mental health specialist. And overall, outpatient mental health spending is 40% lower for African Americans and 25% lower for Latinos. So where do they go? They go to jail, become homeless, or die. Psychiatric Services published findings that individuals from minority communities are less likely to receive adequate follow-up following discharge from a hospital, which we know makes them more likely to be rehospitalized or otherwise trapped in the revolving door of poor outcomes, including criminalization. So this bill, H.R. 2646, addresses the issue of untreated serious mental illness by providing incentives and changing laws in order to help people with serious mental illness. So I have Pat Milam on the show, and I'm going to be inviting Debbie also to come in and talk about the assisted outpatient treatment that her child is in. And I also invited Eleanor Chapman to come on to talk about her daughter, Chelsea Thornton, who really fits the description that I just read. Unfortunately, her mother was unable to get her the care she needed at the hospital, even though she had her involuntarily committed three times. The hospital did not keep her daughter, because there were no beds and there were HIPAA restrictions that did not that were not helpful to her mother in allowing her to participate in the care and treatment of her daughter. And consequently, her daughter took the lives of her children in a psychotic episode. She drowned one in the bathtub, and I believe she shot the other, and is now waiting trial at Orleans Parish Prison. She's been there since 2012, and it's been a real struggle for her mother to make sure that her daughter is receiving the care she needs in prison. So these are some of the challenges that many people in this country are facing. Pat is one of them. And Pat, welcome to the show. You can put some earphones on if you like, and I know you arrived while I was speaking, so we'll just get some technical stuff out of the way, but if as long as you can hear me, okay, go ahead. Welcome to WTUL New Orleans, and thank you so much for coming on to talk about assisted outpatient
Well, thank you,
treatment.
Janice. My pleasure to be here today to talk about, hopefully, to inform the public a little bit more about what goes on in reality and how we're losing many of our loved ones and young people because the system is not set up It's a failed system. It's a broken system, as we hear in the news quite often today. But until it affects you, I wouldn't understand you'd be really interested in this, because you think this type of thing is not going to happen to you. It's going to happen to the poor people or somebody else down the road, but not certainly you. And it's unimaginable to think this would actually happen to you. You had asked me to just give you a little background on my dilemma. My son Matthew was a fairly young child. We're brought up in Metairie, middle class folks. Had company insurance, so insurance was not a problem. I'll bring that out because I'm not quite sure insurance really does much good for anybody. The way the system is set up, it fails for all people. Matthew and his younger brother Michael both were identified as ADHD. Early on in life, we struggled with ADHD and got them the proper medications and things like that through life. But I'll move on to Matthew's 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old life. As many people do with mental issues and teenagers in general, but to combine with mental issues, they self-medicate. So that spirals them down into another area. I often compare this to being in a funnel, and we seem to be treating a lot of people try at the top of the funnel, but I don't see much effort or much valid effort. Certainly not. It's not worthwhile or seeing. I don't see much success in the bottom of the funnel for the severely mentally ill. Congressman Murphy's doing a great job trying to pass this new law. It's been stuck up there for at least 2 years with people violating or questioning violation of civil rights.
In the Energy and Commerce Committee,
yes.
It made it through a first markup and is now sitting in limbo, correct? Waiting for the full committee to mark up the bill so that it can go to the floor and then be debated on by the whole country. So, but anyway, so people know where the bill is in the process.
And I think that's waiting on Congressman Upton to approve that to go to the mm-hmm. full House for the vote. Matthew had problems. He had issues, and certainly a lot of teenagers do. But it really became bad, and I'll talk mostly about the last 6 months of his life, because it was quite apparent to me that the disaster was coming. It was just a matter of when it was going to get there. Matthew lost his younger brother Michael to a drug overdose in 2007. I'll bring that out. And that was a horrific thing for Matthew, because Matthew was at home actually helping guard his brother on that particular night. So that's a traumatic event. And I only mention this because after reviewing the medical files after Matthew's death, you realize that a major event like this happened, but it's almost not even a note in the medical records. And 2 years later, Matthew lost his grandmother. So now we're at 2009. The spiraling kept continuing. Matthew kept failing. He kept dabbling in self-medications, which brings us to the 2011 time period. The first major incident in 2011 was we were home. His mother and I were home with him. He was in the kitchen having a normal breakfast. I got up to leave to meet his father-in-law. I got an emergency phone call like 10 minutes later, come home. Luckily, I was a block from home. And I run in the door, and literally blood is squirting a foot, and that's not an exaggeration, a foot from my son's neck. And he was running around the house in a crazed state, saying he was going to die, and he was going to die, and he was laughing. And he was saying there's nothing I could do about it. I was able to finally tackle him and somehow got a pressure point on it while my wife was screaming for neighbors to help. We were able to save his life that day, and they brought him in. They said he lost, I think, a liter of blood, if I remember right, significant amount of blood. It looked like one of the horror movies you never want to see in your life. What they did, and he was saying he wanted to die. The reason he said later was he had seen a black car in the driveway, and he thought that was the FBI and the CIA and people coming to get him. And so he thought the best way to not be captured by those guys was to take his own life. So, I mean, that ought to be alarm bells going up for the average individual, much less doctors. But what happens in the system? To me, it's a stabilize and release system. And I'm not saying who's responsible. I'm just saying what I see is how it works. They take you in for 2 days, 3 days, 72 hours. the person is like sobering up a drunk, they let you out. Matthew did have a long-term psychiatrist that at the same facility that we brought him to, in most cases. In this case, he went to the UNO Trauma Center. They stabilized him, kept him a few days, and he released. They put him on his medication. He stayed on his medication for a few days. A different kind of person. But they get home. They don't think they need the medication. There's a book by Dr. Javi Amador, I Am Not Sick, and it talks about anosognosia. And if you go into anosognosia, it's something fairly new that was discovered like 1910, where soldiers were coming back and being treated for arms being blown off, but yet they were telling the doctors, my arm's still there. And they didn't even recognize their arm was missing. So it's something these individuals, because of the brain difficulty and the mental illness, they can't recognize they have a mental issue. So therefore, if I don't have a mental issue, why do I need to take the medication? I'm fine, so they quit the medications. So that was one issue. Then Matthew decided he wanted to go back to a rehab facility in Baton Rouge. I walked in the door one day, a month or two later. He said, take me to the place in Baton Rouge. I said, let's go. We got in the car. Unbeknownst to me, he had swallowed a bottle of pills, and I'm driving 70, 80 miles an hour to get up there because he's telling me if I slow down, he's going to jump out the car on the middle of the interstate highway in front of a truck and kill himself. Well, I can't tell you the emotion that rips through a parent in that type of situation. They don't train us for this as parents. I don't know anybody else that's been in that situation. I thought about wrecking on the side of the road. I tried about doing anything, but I still thought he'd probably run in front of a truck. We got him to the facility. We brought him to the hospital in Baton Rouge. He stayed a couple days. They gave him medication. Different person. Came home. He was fine. So we go back through this routine. So then we go. Then about 2 weeks later, he actually drives to the local emergency room, unbeknownst to us, drives in there and tells people that he has a leaking brain, and he says he heard it from the other nurse. Nobody's supposed to tell him he's dying, but yet he wants to know the truth. So they actually do a brain scan on him, let him go. They actually transferred him to another facility, but basically 3 days later, it's like a drunk sobering up a drunk. They go, are you going to kill yourself? Well, these people they're not stupid. They know what they need to say to have their freedom. So they say, no, I'm fine. I can just get out of here. You know, my mom and dad are over-exaggerating. So we go on. It brings us back a couple months later to the October time frame. I was home one day, and I was concerned about Matthew's care. In the meantime, let me back up just a second. In the meantime, I had sent his medical providers, and I'm aware of the HIPAA law, and we'll talk about that more later. I'm aware of the HIPAA law. Generally precludes a doctor from telling you about the patient. I didn't need to know anything about the patient. I was sending emails, phone calls, letters, facts, pictures. I sent a picture to them of my son digging a grave in the backyard. And I said, this is where my son wants to be buried. I sent him a picture of my son standing outside my office at home, begging God to strike him dead and kill him with lightning. I sent him all these things. When in October comes along, he went for a walk with the dog. I went up in his room. I found a small propane tank, some rat poison, knives, all these kinds of things. Well, this is alarming to me. So I call the police. So the police come out and actually tell me that's not illegal to have in your house. And I go, my goodness, you know. If with the terrorism things that's going on, you would think somebody would object to some of this. They told me, no, call back if you got any trouble. My son got back a few minutes later. I said, look, here's the problem. You're not going upstairs. We got in a fight. He threw something at me. We called the police. We got him back to the hospital. At that time, my father-in-law's attorney, we actually started working up commitment papers in order to try to get Matt long-term committed. We realized, though, that if you look at the commitment laws civilly, not if you're involved in AOT as a criminal, but civilly, it takes months, okay? And my thought was, gee whiz, if they let him out, I'm going to have a mentally ill child living at home who is psychotic that's going to live with me, and we're going to go through court for months, and yet I'm going to tell him I'm the one that's trying to put him – in a mental institution. I just didn't see that working. I was afraid that might lead to his death immediately. So we stopped that pursuit. At the hospital, I brought them affidavits from people that helped me around the house saying Matthew said he was going to kill himself, put the noose around his neck. I brought him an affidavit from another psychiatrist that I was seeing for getting some sleeping pills. He said Matthew was going to was in grave danger, needed care. I brought them pictures, more pictures. I told them about 7 or 8 affidavits, hand-delivered them to the medical institution. What's really important to me here now is that HIPAA allows the doctor to receive that information. Okay, I didn't ask the doctor to give me anything back. I didn't ask at that point to talk to him about it. I said, here's what you need to know. After Matthew's death, we got a copy of all the medical records. And amazingly enough, those things are not in his medical record. Those are in a business file. Now, not all of them were in a business file. In fact, we still haven't found out where that facility kept the business file. But to me, that was certainly something all the doctors treating him should have known in prescribing what they need to do for his well-being. But but I would advise everybody, send a certified mail. We did some fax. We did some hand-delivered. We did everything we could to warn the doctors, if you let Matthew out, he'll kill himself. I gave him a letter the week before that saying, if you don't do something 50-50, Matthew will be dead. I called the hospital administrator while Matthew was there begging somebody to talk to me. And I said, you don't have to talk to me about my son. Talk to me about what a parent should do for any person that's having a child come home that's got psychosis and mental issues. No referring phone calls. They said, we can't talk to you. Matthew, we met with them. They kept Matthew an extra day. I actually told the doctors that time, look, Matthew's paranoid schizophrenic still. He's still seeing invisible cops, and told his friend, do you see the invisible cops up in the rafters here at the hospital watching me? I told the doctor that. Next day, the doctor released him, said, well, Matthew said he didn't see anybody, so we're letting him go.
Yeah, this is, the most heartbreaking thing I think about your story is that this is not an unfamiliar story. Mm-hmm. And I really have a hard time not breaking down when I do these interviews, so apologies to listeners if I start to cry. But I wanted to also welcome Debbie to the studio. Debbie, you're nodding your head.
Hi.
Hi. This seems like this isn't an unfamiliar story to you either, and I just, for listeners, want to let you know that I actually met Debbie at a panel that was being hosted by NAMI, where they brought in policymakers and people who are working on alternatives to incarceration for folks with mental illnesses. And I have to say that through the first part of that panel, I just really wanted to go because everybody was talking about stuff that I could get on their websites. It was just policy conversation that wasn't really connecting to anything. And it wasn't until I heard you spoke, Debbie, that I was just really captivated. And I have to say, you were sitting next to the health director, who also suddenly was very captivated in your story, because all of a sudden what we're trying to do at a policy level made sense. But you know, you're nodding your head a lot while Pat was talking, so why don't you let listeners know a little bit about what your experience has been with serious mental illness?
I'd love to do that. So my son was diagnosed, actually he had his first break at the age of 19, and I had no experience with mental illness whatsoever. No history in the family, really just clueless, and you know, the bizarre behavior started, and I had no idea what was going on. I knew also that he was dabbling in drugs, and so when he had his first break, a lot of the doctors actually blamed it on drugs. And so we went that path, and we tried what people said, you know, we should try, which was tough love. Well, I later found out tough love does not work on people with mental illness. And we also experienced him being a revolving door in and out of hospitals. So what happened after that was, for about a 2-year period, my son was in and out of medical facilities, psychiatric facilities. And much familiar to Pat's story, he would get in and they would get him stabilized, and then we would leave the hospital. And I can remember several times we would get in the car, and he would literally say, I'm not taking this medication, and he would throw it out the window. And it was heart-wrenching because we would then have to watch him slowly deteriorate back into a situation from being, you know, totally stabilized and doing well, as well as he could be, you know, with 3 days on meds. And then go back into psychotic episodes, and he couldn't sleep in his room because he thought there was, you know, ghosts, and he couldn't eat in my house because my food was poisoned. He couldn't, I mean, it was horrible. So very quickly learned how to navigate through the coroner's office to have someone committed. And it was really heartbreaking every time I had to have him committed, because police officers have to come to your house and handcuff your child. Then they have to take them to the emergency room where they're evaluated by a psych nurse who 9 times out of 10, unfortunately, isn't even qualified to understand mental illness. Usually it's just an emergency room nurse. And I remember one specific time she came and said, oh, your son is so handsome and polite. There's nothing wrong with him. And I literally had to take her to the side and beg her to reevaluate him. So anyway, this went on and on and on. And my son had a very strong history of noncompliance with his meds. And the pattern that I saw was when he was on his meds, he was okay. When he was not on his meds, he wasn't okay. And not only that, but every time doctors would put him on different medications, a lot of times he was over-medicated. One time they put him on a medication where he was just sleeping 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. He really had no quality of life. So I decided to start doing my own research. I was also locked out of his care because of HIPAA laws, because he was over the age of 18. Mm-hmm. So doctors wouldn't talk to me. So I started doing a lot of my own research, and I found out about NAMI New Orleans, which is National Alliance for Mental Illness, and started going to a support group where that gave me some hope. I started meeting other people that were in similar situations, and I decided that I was not going to give up on my son until I would try every last ditch effort, every medication, everything that I could. And when I started doing some research and talking to people, I heard about something called AOT law, which is the assisted outpatient treatment law. By this time, we had been 2 years with him being pretty sick. Fortunately for me, I had the means and the wherewithal at the time to hire an attorney to, first of all, get an interdiction on my son, which gave me complete power of attorney over him. At the time when I obtained the interdiction, he was in a hospital, in a facility. As soon as I brought them the paperwork with the interdiction, everything changed for me. All of a sudden, the doctors listened to me. I was able to then determine what medication I wanted him on, because oftentimes he would get in a hospital and refuse treatment. Mm-hmm. He was once released from a hospital after a week of refusing mm-hmm. medication. By the way, there are options that they can take. They can call in a second psychiatrist. But it just seemed like I was a number. Mm-hmm. It just seemed like my son was a number. So anyway, I did get the interdiction. After obtaining the interdiction, I proceeded with an attorney to obtain the assisted outpatient treatment, which basically saves a lot of time and a lot of money because the patient is receiving outpatient treatment, which for my son meant I wanted him to get a shot with his medication once a month that would keep him stable. So they did start that in the hospital, and then he was released, and we continued with the shots, and he is a success story. He has been on this medication for almost a year and a half. He's currently working part-time. He has some friends. He has about, you know, a little small group of friends that he does stuff with. He is currently living at home, but that's something that we're taking very slow. And it just changed his life. He actually he was in the hospital, so I had to go to court to obtain this. And it really wasn't that difficult. His actual diagnosis qualified him to get it. And it wasn't as traumatic as I thought it was going to be. And a doctor did have to go just state that he was diagnosed with his, you know, paranoid schizophrenic diagnosis. And I'm trying to think what else is really relevant.
It's wonderful news that your son was able to find success through this program. And I think it's a shame that the program isn't used, more widely. And there's really very little funding, even though I think there are only 4 states in the union that do not have an assisted outpatient treatment law. The first one was in New York. It's well known as Kendra's Law, and most states that have adopted a law have modeled it after Kendra's Law. And there's just so many statistics, and hopefully Judge Johnson will call in and he can elaborate a little bit more about assisted outpatient treatment and what it would do for him as a judge, or he's a retired judge, but, you know, how so many people that come that are incarcerated, pretrial inmates that come before a judge have these kind of difficulties, and really it's an alternative to institutionalization.
It really is.
Where a person can receive treatment in the community. So it's a great law that, you know, in the H.R. 2646 law that Tim Murphy is proposing, this is something that is one of the provisions, and if there could be funding for that, that would be this alternative that people are looking for to warehousing people in hospitals. What we're trying to do is get people treatment in the community.
Absolutely.
But that said, there's still and will always be at times a need for hospitalization, and we can't neglect that or ignore that. We need more beds. But, you know, it's so great to hear your story and heartbreaking that this is a program that probably would have helped Matthew as well, that you were not able to access that kind of treatment.
Well, I was going to ask, Debbie, was your son suicidal at the time you applied to the courts?
I was very lucky. He was not. He was, delusional. Mm-hmm. So for people that don't understand, what the AOT law does is it is a court order that my son has to take his medication. We chose the shot method, and what it does is it holds him accountable and it keeps him on his shot so he can't have these ups and downs. And from my understanding, what would happen is that if he did not take his shot, we live in Jefferson Parish, the Jefferson Parish deputies would come pick him up, bring him to the facility to get the shot, and then bring him home. Mm-hmm. It's very much less traumatic than having someone committed and have to go in the hospital to stay. It also, I feel, wastes the tax people's
sure.
money to have someone, stay in a hospital when all they really need is their medication.
Yeah, that might be one lesson learned from this, is that when in July, after my son's death, we got the medical records. And in July and August, the doctor put in the medical records, his standing psychiatrist, that Matthew was at risk for a very high risk of suicide or other bad outcome. He did that 2 months in a row. We felt that, but we didn't know that a doctor had said that. And one of the things that the AOT law allows that I am really enraged about is it allows the doctors and hospitals to do that. Okay, it would have allowed the doctors in the hospital to have talked to us. Because mm-hmm. if anybody was at risk of being harmed, it was my wife and I, okay? But yet we were never contacted about that. So it's a failure in the systems, and I understand that probably no hospital, no doctor is going to go to their legal department and say, hey, we need to go to court to interdict this person. Our problem was that the hospital and this treating psychiatrist kept saying, no, your son's good to go. He's not grave. He's not ill. He's not suicidal. He took the medicine for 3 days. He's good to go. Mm-hmm. So and if you look at the AOT laws, it actually says when you file this as a parent, it can take sometimes up to 18 days before they ever go to court. And then they're assigned a psychiatrist to evaluate them. So our concern was that could go on for months. And with our son being suicidal at the time, we thought this might put him over the edge. There ought to be an immediate way that you can get success.
Right. Let's take a quick break, and then we've got Judge Johnson on the phone. So we'll dial him in and get some, see if he can impart some wisdom on this as well. But let's take a quick break. I have a couple of announcements, and then we'll get back to the conversation. All right. So we have Judge Calvin Johnson on the phone. Welcome, Judge.
I have been listening, Debbie, to both you and Pat, and it, like with Janet, it makes me want to cry. Okay?
Me
and
too.
I say that to you, both of you, not just because it's words, but because it's true. I've been dealing with it just like you, but dealing with it from trying to get care to people who need it for my almost two decades. And sometimes looking at what exists today is enough to just make you cry. We do have, though, some care in New Orleans, and people need to be aware. I'm going to give out a telephone number, 568-3130. It's answered 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It can get people with kids like you've described in crisis. It can get them at least somewhat, some care, including for parents like you, respite care, because they have connected to it beds where individuals can go for 4 or 5 days and stay again to get back in terms of connected to medication. One of the real issues we have is discharge planning, and that's what you guys have been describing, not necessarily calling it, but that's what it is, the lack of discharge planning.
Yeah.
Kids go into the hospital, they stay those 3 or 4 days, they're discharged to nothing. That's why Nicola Cotton's law came into play, because the guy who killed Nicola Cotton, which is AOT law in Louisiana, but who killed Nicola Cotton was discharged from the hospital to nothing. The person who killed her was discharged, put back on the streets of New Orleans, and connected again to nothing. That problem existed in 2008 when Nicola Cotton was killed, but the sad thing is it exists in 2016 because still we have, as I think, Debbie, you described, I think it was you, but so-called psychiatric nurses or other people supposedly attuned to and educated as regards people with mental health issues, but truly are not, and
yes,
don't understand the fact that without them connected to robust community-based care, they will, what has happened past and happened to your son will continue to happen.
That's right.
And that's just the sad place we are in this country. AOT can work, absolutely can work, but all aspects of the system must be involved in it to make it work. And that's, again, where the problem lies. In Louisiana, we've maybe had 5 or 6 people who've actually come under the AOT statute or law, and in the most, if not all of them, they're doing very well.
Yes.
Based on what I just said, you would think we'd have more.
Yeah, I'm going to put you on speakerphone, Judge, so you can hear Debbie. She's and then I'll put you back. I'll dial you back in online. Hang on one sec.
Okay.
There you go.
Yes, I do agree. It's been very successful with my son. It is a shame that more people don't have access to it. It's a very expensive process, and I do work with people with NAMI. They refer people to me that wish to access the AOT laws, and unfortunately, they're roadblocked when they don't have the financial ability to pay for an attorney and a private doctor and things like that, because a lot of doctors are hesitant to enforce this.
Metropolitan Human Service District, by statute, in the AOT law in Louisiana, that agency is mandated, actually, where a need is as regards the AOT to go forward with it. However, for the agency to go forward, you have to have doctor participation. And in so many instances, with all respect to doctors, they don't want to participate in it. And that's been one of the problems with actually going forward with the law, is the fact that some medical providers don't want to be involved with it. That's been a problem.
Yeah, Judge, wouldn't you call that medical negligence, so that the doctors don't do what they know is available to do, and basically they stabilize and release the patient knowing he's not going to take his medication or a slight risk?
It's the fact that we don't train them. See, medical schools are negligent in how they train providers. They don't recognize that 1 in 4 of their patients is suffering from a mental illness. Medical schools say the words to that, but they don't recognize the reality of it, and the providers, be them nurses, be them nurse practitioners, be them doctors, don't necessarily engage to the extent that they will actually do what's necessary to deal with patients that they see every day that's suffering from a mental illness. Now, and you ratchet that up to people who are seriously and persistently mentally ill, and then the medical providers tend to run for cover.
Yes, I find that one of the big roadblocks is that people do not want to access this because they're afraid of the consequences. I think they don't want to get sued, and you know, they're worried about HIPAA laws. We are locked out of talking to doctors about our loved ones. And I think for me, one of the biggest keys in having a success in something like this is for medical professionals in psychiatric to realize how important loved ones are in these diagnoses and to be alert of when our loved ones are actually going into an episode.
I couldn't agree more with all of you on that. And I actually did write an op-ed, which you can read at The Lens, called Forbidden Knowledge, about the problems with HIPAA rules and proposing some reform to HIPAA rules. And I know Senator Troy Carter, Louisiana state legislator, is very interested in possibly working on a bill for next session. It was too late for this session to get the changes that we need. So that caregivers can be active participants in the care and treatment of their children. So it's a very, very important point. You were going to say something, Judge?
Well, yes. With that piece you read at the beginning of this from Representative Murphy and how he described those issues, including how he describes the need to tweak the HIPAA laws, is just so necessary. Because when you're talking about an 18, 19-year-old, you're talking about one who, as David described, who has that first break, the parent ought to be able to discuss all of this. The reality is that 18-year-old, 19-year-old is a child. Regardless of what we say in terms of age, the reality is that person is a child. And the parent ought to be able to discuss that health care need with their care provider, because this is my child.
Absolutely. And I think when you're dealing with families, you know, some people are a better resource than others, but people that are underserved and under-resourced who already have incredible difficulties trying to care for their children because they're busy working two jobs or whatever. Like my friend Eleanor is working two jobs today. Her daughter's in jail, you know, and it's just, you can imagine the hurdles for folks that have insurance, folks that have resources cannot get care for their children. So just imagine how difficult it is for people that do. But go ahead, Debbie, you were about to say something.
Oh, I was just agreeing with you that I facilitate a support group for loved ones that have family members with mental illness in Metairie. And I often see not only parents, but say a sister of someone that's older and has a mental illness and won't leave the house, or now we have children who are taking care of grown elderly parents that have mental illness, and they also are locked out of the system. So we're not just talking about parent-child relationships. We're talking about whoever has a loved one and they want to be involved in the care, the doctor should be able to listen to them, because these are the people that are saying, look, my mother is, you know, 70 years old and she has not come out of her house for weeks. You know, she's hearing voices and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, what can we do? And then she's locked out because then again, the mother is an adult over the age of 18, and doctors by law are not allowed to talk to someone if the person doesn't allow them to.
Yeah.
And the mentally ill people oftentimes don't want the loved ones to be able to talk to the doctors because they will do anything to stay off of their meds and out of hospitals.
Absolutely. And that's when these tragedies happen. We have about 4 or 5 minutes left in the show. Y'all, if you want to just give your closing remarks and let folks know if you have any resources or contact information. Judge, you had a number. I'm going to dial you back in a minute or put you back in the system, in the engineering system. Please let listeners know what is available right now. I know there's very little, but what should people do?
One point I would make that I didn't say is that ultimately, after they let my son out against our strong demands that he was going to kill himself, a week later he did take his life. With regards to HIPAA, I would point out that a lot of people didn't know, and I didn't know until I researched this. Basically, the federal government has set up HIPAA with the lawmakers and the doctors, where you can't sue the federal government, or can't sue your doctor or healthcare provider if they do something wrong and give out your information. And it's just amazing. All you can do is complain to the federal government, and they could take it forward. Now, there are some new court cases that's coming up about that, but generally the government has protected the doctors and medical providers if they make a mistake. Mm-hmm. The other thing I would say is that doctors and hospitals have told me point blank, they are all trained, no matter what, don't say anything. Just period. Be safe. Don't get us in trouble. Just don't say anything. Be safe. Don't talk to the patients, family.
Right. No, this is something that we definitely have a lot of work to do on, and hopefully the Louisiana state legislator can pass some legislation that we can implement changes that we need without having to rely on federal legislation. Like Pat, as you mentioned, there is a bill. It's a great bill. It's being it's in limbo right now in a subcommittee because of politics. So, but meanwhile, we have to find creative solutions, and we may need to find creative ways to fund things that we need that, you know, aren't traditional, because we have to, because the need is so great. But Judge,
one last thing I would just say, call your congressman, your senator, yes, whoever else. I just talked to Congress Murphy's office this week. That's what they're asking everybody to do. Call somebody, call Mr. Upton, call somebody and tell them your opinions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Families, if anyone's experiencing, you know, any issues with untreated serious mental illness, whether it's a loved one or a friend, call your representatives. Talk about it. That's the one thing, that this is a silent epidemic because people have not wanted to talk about it. And now is the time. If we're going to make changes, there's bipartisan support for reducing mass incarceration, which we can't talk about unless we talk about mental illness, because 65 to 70% of people who are incarcerated have a mental illness. It may be a mild one, or it may be more severe. 15 to 20% of people have serious mental illness who are in jails and prisons, which is entirely disproportionate to the average statistic in the country nationally. And then there's also bipartisan support now for mental health reform. So now is the time to talk about it. And I'm worried that if we don't, that window will close and we'll be back to the what has been health, mental health care for people, which is having to go through the jail and prison system where they do not get the care that they need, which is why we've got ACLU and jail monitors and people who are you know, screaming about people who are being abused and mistreated in jail, because, you know, law enforcement officers and sheriff deputies are not trained doctors or social workers. All they know is how to treat behavior. And when someone with a mental illness is acting out because of bad behavior, it isn't necessarily because it's even intentional. It might be the mental illness that they're seeing, not the person. So, you know, these are very systemic and ingrained problems that we have. And so we do need to talk about it. Debbie, you had something to say. And then, Judge, you had a phone number that people can call. So just stand by, and I'd like to get that number. Go ahead.
I'd also just like to mention that not only are most of them incarcerated, the rest are homeless,
right,
and on the streets.
Or suicidal.
And because mm-hmm. family members like us have given up hope, and, you know, you cannot, it's very difficult to force an adult to take medication when they don't want to, and when they stay off their meds, a lot of them become homeless. But anyway, I would just encourage people to stay active with NAMI New Orleans. There's a lot of resources. I'd just like to say I do have a support group. It's in Metairie the fourth Thursday of every month from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Beth Israel on West Esplanade. If you're interested, it's on the NAMI website.
Great. Thank you, Debbie. And Judge, you had a phone number for people in crisis. Who should they call?
Absolutely. That number is 504-568-3130. It's answered 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It'll help those who are dealing with a family member or friend who's in crisis. They will deal with that person in crisis till the crisis is resolved. That includes having a connection to that person who goes to the hospital, but then having a connection to that person when they are discharged. So that's 568-3130. It is care. And at least, at the very least, it ought to be used to the point where there's waiting lists, the day there or not.
That's great. Thank you so much, Everett. Thank you all for joining in this conversation. It's not over. We're going to keep talking about it. I know, Judge, you have a show also on Wednesdays. WHIV, I suppose I shouldn't be giving out our competitors, you know, call numbers, but you have a very important show as well, and you've had me on your show to talk about this, about the proposal that I came up with for a one-stop shop in New Orleans, which is, you know, a national practice now. It's a best practices model. And so, you know, again, there are so many issues that tie into this one thing, and we could talk about it probably all day. And we will. We'll have everybody back, and let's keep the conversation going. And last thoughts, Pat?
Thank you to you and the judge for your efforts. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you.